John Bishop is English by birth. Drug addiction held him captive until the light of salvation broke the chains. By searching the scriptures, he was encouraged to proclaim the heavenly message. Today, he follows calls from all over the world to tell how God intervened in his life and to proclaim the divine message to make us free. We desire that you, dear viewer, may be reached by the Spirit of God and see the importance of this message in your life. Dear hearer, no more bananas. Yahweh's blessings to you. Dear hearer, testimony of John Bishop.
Well, if you like, I can tell you the story of my conversion and how my life changed when I found the Lord. All right, let's walk on a bit and I'll tell you my story. So I suppose my story really starts when I was 14 years old. And maybe I should give you a little bit of my background as well, because I wasn't born into a Christian family. My father was nominal Christian, used to go to church Christmas, Easter, times like that. But my mother was actually a spiritualist, and so the real foundation for my beliefs was a spiritualist belief. And of course I got involved in all that kind of thing as well, from quite an early age. One of the other great influences in my life was, I suppose the same as any other young person at that time, I was really into the rock music that was being played. I followed the rock stars. I had my own particular favourites. I can remember them now, some of them, like Jimi Hendrix, the Beatles. Frank Zappa was a particular favourite. And, you know, they have one of the biggest influences on my life because I was following them as my heroes. So I started to take the clothes that they were wearing, do the things that they were doing. And there was one thing that was very important that they were doing. They were also talking about in their music as well, which was taking drugs. And so by the time I was 14 years old, I made the decision that I was actually going to go out and start taking drugs. And so one day I went out to a rock festival with the idea of going out and buying some drugs. And it was particularly easy. I was sitting there, people were all around, were selling drugs. And so I got some cannabis and I tried it. I didn't really know what I was doing with it. I needed someone to teach me how to use it. But I remember coming home from that rock concert with cannabis in my pocket. And I didn't know it at that time, but that was going to be the beginning of me smoking cannabis for the next 14 years, every day of my life. Now, of course, one of the things is, if you're taking drugs every day, drugs don't come to you freely. You've got to do something to pay for the drugs. Now, at the time, I was really just a schoolboy, and I was smoking cannabis every day. And so sooner or later, you've got to do something where you're going to go out and get the money to pay for the drugs. So the situation I was in was that I was spending all my pocket money on getting drugs, and then when I left home, the money that I was getting for rent, for food, and for all the other things necessary, I was also spending that on drugs. The time would have to come when I'd have to find another solution. Now, of course, you might be thinking, why not just go out and work? But if you're spending all your time taking drugs, you're not in a fit state to go and work. Plus, I was at college as well. So I decided to do something else. There were two things that I actually did to raise money. The first one just came because of my hunger. I went out to a supermarket one day and I was hungry. There was food in the supermarket. And so I decided just to put the two of us together and do what came naturally at that time. So I started stealing the food. So the next stop was really an obvious one. I started stealing, but stealing to order. What I mean is that people would come to me and they would say that they wanted something stolen from a shop, so I'd go and do it, and they'd pay me in money or they'd pay me in drugs. For me, it was a good system. It kept me in money, it kept me in drugs, but for other people, it wasn't so good. And soon along home came those men in blue, you know, with the cars with the flashing lights, and I was arrested for stealing. Well, I had to decide on another method. There was something else that I had been doing previously, which really had worked. I used to go and buy a little block of cannabis, and I would sell some of it for double the price that I paid for it and keep the rest. And this way I had my drugs and I had my money. And so I went back to doing that, and I started selling cannabis. Now, this was actually quite a successful thing to do as far as I was concerned. I had the money, I had the drugs, and life was continuing in a good vein for me. However, there were certain rules that we had made between ourselves. So what we decided between myself and other people I was working with selling the drugs was that I was only going to sell the drugs that I myself was taking. Well, realistically, I sold cannabis and maybe a little bit of some of the psychedelic drugs. I'd made a pact with my best friend because we knew the dangers of taking heroin and cocaine. And so what we said was that we were never going to take these drugs. And to reinforce it, we would only take the drug if we were in the presence of the other one. So we could always stop each other from actually taking these drugs. Well, one day my best friend came to me with some disturbing news. He told me that he had taken heroin, and he said to me that it was the best thing he'd ever tried in his life. Now, for me, that was then a bit of a problem, because he came to me and said, "John, you want to try it?" And so, because I got such a good report from him, I decided that I would actually try it. And so I tried the heroin, and I remember it was a Friday evening when I first took it. And it was the best. It was the best thing I'd ever taken. And that's why it was so dangerous. Because it was the best. Because when Saturday came, I just wanted to try it again. And so on Saturday, I took it. Saturday, it wasn't as good as it was on Friday. And then Sunday came along, and Sunday, I thought, well, why not try it again? And on Sunday, it wasn't as good as it was on Saturday. And you can see how the pattern develops. Every day you're trying to get on to get that same high that you got the first time. But having said that, I wasn't stupid. I saw what was coming, and I could see I was going to get addicted if I kept doing that. So on Monday, I stopped. And so for the rest of the week, I didn't take heroin at all. But when Friday came, that's when I took heroin. Heroin was the drug of the weekend. And from Friday night through till Sunday night, I was taking heroin and was completely out of my head. I was in a different dimension. It was like dreamland all over the weekend. But I was very strict with it. I'd always said weekends only. Well, sometimes if I'd had a good week, then Thursday evening, the weekend started on Thursday. And so I started taking heroin on Thursday, and then it went through till Sunday night. Well, if I had some business to do on Monday, sometimes I'd take just a little bit on Monday morning just to, you know, feel normal and not to feel too bad. But still, I made sure that during the week, I wasn't taking it at all. And so only on the weekend, from Thursday night through to Monday night, then I was taking heroin. But for the rest of the week, I wouldn't touch it. Well, sometimes just a little bit on Tuesday. Just to make myself feel normal, you know? But I mean, Thursday through to Tuesday, only then. The rest of the week, I wouldn't touch it. So on Wednesday, I was clean. I had no problems. Well, all right, maybe Wednesday morning I'd have just a little touch. And, you know, and if you've had a bit on Wednesday morning, you might as well have some Wednesday evening as well, because you're buzzing. And, of course, you've guessed it. One day the weekend started, and it just went on. I don't know for how many weeks it went on, but at some point it was going to have to end. And it did. It ended when I ran out of heroin. I didn't really think that was going to be a problem. I mean, as far as I was concerned, I wasn't addicted. We looked at the addicts, we looked at the junkies as being like the lowest form of life. And no way did we want to be like that. But it was strange that when I actually ran out of heroin, I was interested in getting some more. And so I began to phone around people and to see what was available. And I remember I phoned the people up and I said, well, have you got any heroin? And they said, no. And I said, well, that's okay, I'm just interested. You know, I don't need it or anything, I'm just interested. And then that evening I'd phone around again and still there wasn't any. It's okay, hey, it's no problem. I mean, I wasn't addicted. And the next day, the next morning, I'd get up and I'd start phoning around. And the strange thing was that after a day or so, I started to get a cold. My nose was running, my eyes were watery, my mouth was full of saliva. I was getting headaches and stomach cramps. And I thought, well, maybe it's good that I don't have the heroin. Because if I'm going to have a cold, let me just have a cold. I was smoking the cannabis, but it was having no effect. It was just like smoking cigarettes. And then I was phoning the people and I was saying, have you got any heroin? And they were saying no. And well, all right, I said I didn't need it, but somewhere deep inside, something was telling me that life would be a lot better if I had the heroin. The next night I went to bed and the stomach cramps were so intense, the headaches, the aches that were coming all over my body, my arms were aching, my legs were aching, and I couldn't sleep at night. As I lay down in the bed, it felt as if somebody had taken an electrical cord and plugged it into my spine. And I found myself just jumping up and leaping out of bed. And then I was getting so depressed. And I was never really, I wasn't depressed before, I was a happy guy. Yet I found myself getting really depressed for no reason at all. And I was on the phone talking to one guy and saying, asking if he'd got the heroin. And I found myself I just started crying and was begging him. And I was saying to people, I know you've got the heroin. Well, can't you just give me some, just one little bit? All I wanted was just a little bit, just enough to make me feel normal. And I was saying, what do you want me to do? I mean, if it's money, I'll pay double. That's no problem. You want me to steal something? I'll go and steal something. You want me to go and kill somebody? Whatever you want, I'll do it. Just give me the little bit of heroin. It was at that point that I realized that maybe I really did have a problem. Now, if I'm going to explain to you now what I was going through, we come to a bit of a problem, because it's really hard to explain to somebody what an addiction is like unless you've actually had an addiction yourself. And I guess neither of you have been through that process of having an addiction. So I've got to find some way of describing it to you. And perhaps the easiest way is if I tell you a story to try and give you an idea of what it feels like. All right then, so let me tell you a story, and this looks like the perfect spot to tell it. All right, imagine that this is a jungle, and we are walking through the jungle on the jungle path. Now, what you have to do is very simple. You've got to walk from here through to there. So, you start walking down the jungle. As you're walking through the jungle, there's a little monkey about this high that comes running out of the jungle. He runs out of the jungle, climbs up your leg, and sits on top of your shoulder like this. This monkey is so cute. I mean, he's just so cute. And you want to stroke him and pat his little head. And you know that you've got with you some bananas. So you've got this little monkey, and you've got the bananas. So you think, why not give the monkey a banana? So you give the monkey a banana. The monkey takes a banana, and he starts to eat it. And when he's finished the banana, he just pulls like this on your ear. You know what he's saying to you? He's saying, give me another banana. And you think, oh, he's so cute, little monkey. So you take another banana, and you feed him another banana. When he's finished this one, he's pulling like this with the hairs on the back of your neck. And you know what he's saying? He's going, give me another banana. Oh, it's so cute. So you give him another banana. But when he finishes this one, he starts to kind of claw at the back of your head. This time he's going, give me another banana. But it hurts. And when you feel where he's doing it, you can see there's blood. And you notice as you look at this monkey that he started off about this size, but now he's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so you give the monkey another banana, but you know that when he finishes this banana, he He's going to have got bigger, and whatever he's going to do to you, it's going to hurt. So what are you going to do? The solution is simple. You give the monkey the banana before he asks for it. So now, the monkey's got a banana, you've got the next one ready, you're feeding the monkey bananas, and you start walking through the jungle. And so off you go, walking through the jungle, feeding the monkey bananas, no problems, everything's cool, except you've just run out of bananas. So now what are you going to do? I mean, the monkey's here on your shoulder, but by now the monkey, he's a big guy, he's about this size. When he asks for the next banana, he's going to rip your head off. And you've got no bananas left. So you're standing there on the jungle path thinking, what am I going to do when this guy finishes his banana? And as you look around, there's a banana tree over there. Simple. Off into the jungle to go and get some more bananas. So you go into the jungle. And you start picking the bananas off the banana tree. And you're feeding the monkey. And he's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And soon the tree looks like it's running out of bananas. And you've got to look for the next tree where that one is. And it seems now that all your time is taken up looking for banana trees, picking bananas, feeding the monkey. You've got no time to get back to the path. You've got no time to carry on walking through the jungle. Your whole life is just devoted to now feeding this monkey. Well, I guess you can see where the story is going. The end result of this story is very simple. Somewhere over there in the jungle, your dead body is laying. Over it, there stands a massive great gorilla. And ever so often, he bends down and he picks up the body and he shakes it. And he says, give me another banana. That's what it's like when you've got an addiction. It's like having a monkey on your back. And no matter how hard you try, you can't get that monkey off your back. I cried like a baby trying to get that monkey off my shoulder. Well, finally, I've got that monkey off my back. You would think, having been through an experience like that, that it would tell you a big lesson. And certainly I wasn't in any hurry to have a monkey back on my back. And so for the next 2 weeks or so, however long it was, I didn't touch heroin at all. But, you know, the strange thing is, you have an experience like that, but somehow those monkeys kept coming back. I kept ending up with a monkey on my back. No matter how many times I got rid of it, always the monkey came back. So you would have thought, having gone through all of that just to get that monkey off my back, that I would have learned a big lesson from that. But the sad thing is that I didn't at all, and soon I found myself with another monkey on my back, and I would get rid of that one, and then I get another monkey, and I get rid of that one. And so my life continued. And it seemed as if something really dramatic was going to have to happen to break this cycle. The way things were looking, my friends were in hospital, they were going to prison, some of them even died, all because we got involved in the drug taking. And now also we were doing a lot of drug running as well. We were involved in importing the drugs from country to country, as well as selling them in England. Well, one morning something did happen to break this cycle. Early in the morning there was a pounding at my front door, and I thought that it's a bit early for someone to come looking to buy drugs. And I was right. When I finally opened the door, there were the officers of Scotland Yard and the customs officers. And they come in to bust me. And so once they were inside the house, they got me. They had the drugs. They had the money. They had everything. And I found myself being taken off to the local cells, where they held me in detention and prepared me, ready to go to court. Well, I knew it was going to be another month before I was ending up going to court to be tried for everything, but I also knew that they'd got me. They had everything they needed, and as far as I was concerned, I was going to go to prison probably for a good few years. As I told you before, a lot of my friends had gone to prison, and I was the last one that was left to go. And so a month later, I was in the court. And I looked around for the officers who had arrested me, but they didn't appear. Instead, there was a man from the local police station who came, and he asked me by name. And this was a strange thing. He asked me if I was going to plead guilty or innocent. And I said, well, they got everything, so I might as well plead guilty. So I said, all right, I'm going to plead guilty. And he said, all right, you're doing me a favour, I'm going to do you a favour. I didn't know what the guy meant by this. So we went into the court and everybody said what they had to say. My defence lawyer couldn't say anything. This was the third time I'd been arrested. And he was saying to the judge, well, you can't give him probation or a suspended sentence because he's had that before. You can't fine him because he hasn't got any money. And as he went through all the alternatives, the only thing was left was for me to go to prison. So you can imagine how I was feeling about my lawyer. Then the policeman stands up and he said about what a nice young man I was, what a nice house I had, how I wasn't really a dealer, but it was just me and a few friends who got some money together. And it happened to be my turn to buy the drugs, and I got busted. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, that's right, that's it. And when it came to the sentencing, the judge looked at me and he said, well, I'm going to give you 2 years, conditional discharge. And I was shocked. I was a free man. I got to walk out of the courtroom. And I was going around to all my friends. I'd arranged for them to bring me drugs in prison or whatever. But now I was free. And so as soon as I got out of the court, I just rushed off and bought some drugs and decided to celebrate. But then I started getting these phone calls. There were phone calls from people asking me, where's the 16 kilos of heroin that I ordered? Where's the 2 kilos of cannabis? I didn't know what these people were, or who they were, but they were threatening me with violence as well. And so I was saying to them, okay, come round to my house. I was used to this kind of lifestyle. I had my own minders. I had people who would go and break legs for me, people who were carrying guns. And so I wasn't really frightened about the violence, but I wanted to know who these people were. It was suggested to me that perhaps it was the police. And I challenged one of these guys on the phone. And I said to him, I know you. You're a police officer, I know you. And he actually admitted it. And he said to me that they wanted me inside and that they were going to watch me and wait for me to make the right move. And then they were going to bust me again and make sure that I went into prison. This meant I had to do one thing. One thing I'd avoided for many years, never wanted to do, I had to find a job. Now, the problem is that if you're a drug dealer and you've been arrested for theft and for drugs, you don't really find too many adverts saying, wanted ex-drug dealer to make money. So I had to start at the bottom of the pile, and I was washing dishes, sweeping floors, cleaning toilets. At one point, I was even working in a mortuary, wheeling the dead bodies backwards and forwards. I was doing anything to earn money. But at the same time, I was also taking the drugs as well. And then I got my big break. I actually got a job working in an office. Well, I was cleaning the waste paper bins backwards and forwards in an office, but it was an office job nevertheless. One day, I was in the office, lunchtime had come, and I went to the canteen, and I was sitting there with my food, and somebody came and sat next to me. So, there I was, sitting in the canteen, and then this person came and sat down next to me, asked if the seat was free, and I said yes, and then they asked me if I'd like a drink of water, and they went off and they got water for the two of us, and we began to speak. And I remember being asked what I was doing that evening. I said I had nothing planned, and I in turn said, what are you doing this evening? And my new friend said they have nothing planned either. So we agreed to meet together after work and to do nothing together. So we met together after work. When work had finished, we met up and we had a decision to make. The decision was, what were we going to do? Well, for myself, the choices were simple. My first choice was, let's go for a drink. And my friend said, no, I don't drink. So I said, okay, what else could we do? Hey, do you want to go to the disco? Do you want to go dancing? My friend said, no, I don't dance. So then I thought, what else could we do? And I said, you want to take some drugs? My friend said, no, I don't take drugs. I was running out of ideas. I reached into my pocket, I pulled out my cigarettes, and I said, do you want a cigarette? My friend said, no, I don't smoke. So I said, wait a minute. You don't drink, you don't go to the disco, you don't take drugs, you don't smoke. What do you do? My friend said, I'm a Christian, I go to church. I said, whoa, that's enough for me. I know all about Christians, and I want nothing to do with them. My friend looked at me and said, do you know the people that go to my church? I said, I hope not. So the next question was, well, if you don't know the people that go to my church, how do you know they're all hypocrites? So my friend said to me, perhaps you're the hypocrite. I said, me? How am I the hypocrite? They said, well, you don't know the people that go to my church, but you accuse them. So I said, listen, I know the people that go to that church are hypocrites. So my friend said, well, why don't you prove it? So now my friend had a proposition for me. The suggestion was a simple one. Why didn't I go down to the church and prove that the hypocrites were there? It was not a suggestion I wanted to accept. This is where my friend came out with another proposition. The suggestion was, not only should I go to the church, but also afterwards I could come back and have lunch with them. Now, the idea of a home-cooked family meal quite got to me. You see, at the time, I was living in, how would I call it, a one-room bedsit. Do you know what that is? Let me give you an idea. Over here's the lounge. Over here's the kitchen. My head's in the bedroom. It's all just one room. And I had no cooking facilities at all. So the idea of going somewhere and having a home-cooked family meal, it got me hook, line, and sinker, and I decided to go to the church. So I said to my friend, okay, Sunday morning, what time do we meet? My friend said, no, not Sunday, it's Saturday. I said, what a funny Christian, doesn't even know what day they go to church on. So I agreed. We set a time, Saturday morning, we were going to meet together, and I was going to church. Of course, there's one other thing that I didn't tell you. I didn't tell you what I was looking like. Now, you remember I said I was into the drugs and everything, and we're talking about this was through the 70s. In the 70s, everybody was a hippie. You know what it means to be a hippie? Everybody had long hair. Well, I had long hair. I mean, I had long hair. And my hair was so long, I could actually sit on my hair. I had a full beard at that time. I had two earrings, you can still see the holes in there. And I had the chains and the bracelets and rings. I even had an ankle chain. And of course my jeans, they were the ones with the big flares. So anyway, here we were Saturday morning going down to church. And as you can imagine, I went into the church and I pushed open the doors and And I looked at all the people, and all the people looked at me, and I just kind of sat down very quietly. There was a guy speaking, and I listened to what he was saying, but it was all really boring, and I just waited till the sermon was over and I could get out of the church. So then I came out of the church, met up with my friend outside, and my friend said to me, "Well, did you see the hypocrites?" I said, "Hey, I saw them. They were there." My friend said, "Well, who were the hypocrites?" I said, "Well, I don't know who and who were the hypocrites, but, I mean, they were there." My friend said, "Oh, don't worry, John. Come on, let's go and eat." So we went home and we sat down to eat. I had never seen food like that before. The table that was spread out in front of me was beautiful. Food of different kinds on it. And I said to my friend, I said, "Do you always eat like this?" My friend said, "No, no. Only today, because today is God's special day, so we have special food." "Hey, it's okay for me." And we sat down and we ate together. Well, when the food was over, I said my goodbyes and off I went. But my friend said to me, "John, would you like to come back and eat with us again next week?" I said, "Yeah, okay." They said, "Why don't you come down Friday evening and have supper with us?" I said, "Do you eat like this on a Friday evening?" They said, "Oh, yes." So I said, "Okay, why not? I'll come down Friday evening." So the next Friday, I went back down there. We'd set a time, and I was there exact time, knocked on the door, and my friend came to the door and I said, "Am I in time for supper?" My friend said, "Yes, you're just in time. A Bible study." I said, "Oh, good." And I went in and it was time for Bible study. I couldn't believe it. I had to go through half an hour of Bible study, but then I got my food. But I ate my food, and my friend said, "Would you like to come back next week?" I said, "What, to eat?" He said, yes, come back to eat. So I said, "Okay." So the next week I went back, but the next week I went a little bit later. I knocked on the door and I said, "Oh, hope I'm not too late." I said, "No, in fact, you're just in time for Bible study." I said, "Oh, great, very good." And we went in for Bible study. Do you know, the strange thing was, every week they invited me back. Every week, I went a little bit later, a little bit later, a little bit later. But every week, I was just in time for Bible study. Strange, huh? Now, I'm not stupid. I knew exactly what they were trying to do. They were inviting me back every week, getting me to have a Bible study. They were trying to convert me to Christianity. But I was a Buddhist. And so as they were giving me Christianity, so I was giving them back Buddhism. And so a kind of fight started while we were there. The Christianity on the one hand, the Buddhism on the other side. I remember they'd given me a Bible to read. I'd accepted it. It was a nice thought, but I hadn't really put too much importance on it. I'd thrown it to one side at home. But now I decided that I had to stop all this constant pressure from them about the Christianity. Now, I knew that the Bible was just a book of stories, that there was no truth in it. And so I also knew it was full of errors. So I thought the easiest thing to do is just to get some of the errors out of the Bible and hit them with those errors, and they'd soon be quiet. So I sat at home and I started to read the Bible. I remember I began in the New Testament. And as I came to one area where I saw there was an error, I'd take it to them on a Friday evening. I'd say, "Wait, before we start with the Bible study, what about what it says here? How do you explain that then?" They'd explain it. I'd say, "Well, all right, okay, well, wait a minute," and I'd find somewhere else, and I'd say, "Ah-ha-ha, what it says here in the New Testament, now look what it says in the Old Testament. Explain that then." And they did. So I found myself taking this Bible with me everywhere, and every spare moment I had, I was reading the Bible, still trying to catch them out, trying to find some area where I could prove that they were wrong. I remember one day in particular, I went into the pub with the Bible. I went to the bar and I bought myself a pint of beer. And I sat down, and I had the Bible in one hand and the beer in the other hand. And as I raised the glass, I was just about to drink the beer, and I glanced at the Bible, and this is what it said. It said, man cannot serve two masters, for either he will love the one and hate the other, or he will hate that one and love the other one. Man cannot serve God and mammon. And I looked at what I had in my hands. And one side was the beer, and the other side was the Bible. Bible and the beer. And I shut the Bible and drank the beer. But you know, it worried me. I mean, it was a strange thing to read at that time. It was almost as if God or somebody was trying to speak to me through that Bible. And from that time on, I had a little bit more respect for that book as I was reading it. And I suppose that it was at that point when I began to actually study the Bible, rather than just trying to find errors in it. As I continued reading the Bible, I began to look at the kind of life that I was living, and the life that others were living, who were supposed to be Christians. I saw some kind of differences. Now, remember, while I was doing this, I was still taking drugs. I was still really in that lifestyle. And then I bumped into another scripture. And this one really quite got to me. You know the scripture, John chapter 3, verse 16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not die, but would have everlasting life. And I looked at my life. I mean, my life revolved around the drugs. I'd get up in the morning, I'd smoke a joint. I'd come home in the evening, I'd smoke a joint. If I was going out to the cinema, I'd smoke a joint. Before eating, I'd smoke. After eating, I'd smoke. Anything I was going to do, I took drugs while I did it. I couldn't go to bed at night without smoking a joint. If somebody went to me and said, let's go on a holiday together, the first question I'd ask is, can you get drugs there? And if they told me you couldn't, I'd say, well, can I take them with me? If I couldn't, I wouldn't go. I began to look at my life and I wondered, could I really call it my life? I mean, it was controlled by the drugs. And where was it going to end up? I saw my friends, they were all going to hospital, going to prison, some of them dying, some of them addictions that they were dying from in front of my eyes. I didn't really have a life. And yet here was Christ, offering me this chance, offering me the chance of everlasting life. And I think at that point I faced two roads. There was one road going off that way, which I knew led to death. That was the only answer. Yet here was another road, the road that Christ was offering. I read that scripture again. But this time when I read it, it said something different. It said, for God so loved me that he gave his only begotten Son, that if I believed in him, I would not die, but I would have everlasting life. I began to wonder, would it be worth taking a chance on Christianity? You know, to be honest with you, I tried everything else. I started off with spiritualism. I got into the occult. From that I got into what we call now the New Age movement. I was taking drugs, alcohol. I tried everything, but nothing worked. And so I considered maybe if I tried Christ. I mean, when it came to it, what did I have to lose? I mean, if it didn't work, I wasn't any worse off. But if it did work, so I came to a point of decision making. If I wanted to get out of this world of drugs, if I wanted to take this thing away from me, that had taken hold of my life, the only option was to surrender my life to Christ. So at that point, I got down on my knees and I said a very simple prayer. I said, God, if you're there, if you're really there, and if you have got this power, then prove it to me. Prove it to me in my life, right now. Take this addiction away from me. And I decided at that point to stop taking the drugs. It was a hard thing to do. As I stopped, I waited for the withdrawal to come. I knew what to expect. The first 24 hours, it's no problem. When the drug's still in your body, you don't really feel anything. But as the next 24 hours come, I waited for that pain to start again. It didn't come. And I waited another day. And soon the days became a week, and the weeks became months, and the months became years, and I'm still waiting. The withdrawal pain never came. It seemed like I was free. And when you found a power like that, what can you do? You can't let go of it. I knew I had to commit my life to Christ. And you know, I'll tell you something. Ever since that day, I've never looked back. God has been so good. He's given me a completely new life. And that new life is much better than the old life that I had. I feel like a new man, like I've been really reborn. And God has blessed me in so many ways. Now He's given me a work to do, provided me with a lovely wife and a family. And each day I praise God for the miracle that He did in my life. And the amazing thing is that really it's not that big a miracle. He can do the same in anybody's life. All they have to do is be prepared to trust Him, to decide to give their lives over to Him, and He'll make all things new. He can give everybody that new life. But of course, the other promise is that it's an eternal life. When Jesus Christ comes again, we're all going to go.
For Yahweh so loved the world that He gave His one and only Son, that whoever believes in Him shall not perish but have eternal life. John 3:16. For Yahweh so loved the world that He gave His one and only Son, that whoever believes in Him shall not perish but have eternal life.